Bianca had taken it on as sort of her own catchphrase, and it became the name and theme of her comedy tour. That evening, Del Rio re-grammed my post on social media with a derogatory, name-calling comment towards me. Soon, LGBT advocates were flooding my page, objecting to my use of Rio's phrase, and writing words of hate and anger on my post. This exchange upset me deeply. First, because I knew my own heart in posting this picture, and no one likes to be misunderstood. My intentions came from a pure place. I needed a boost of encouragement that day, and I shared my post hoping it would offer the same to others. Second, the comments on my Instagram account were divisive and hurtful to others, and people were beyond disrespectful. I want to live out my faith even when the going gets tough, maybe especially then. Because my purpose is to glorify God, I can look at even a difficult situation like this and see it as an opportunity to do what I was put on the planet to do. Barefaced in my bathroom, I stared at my iPhone screen and took a deep breath. It's easy to get heated up when someone attacks, especially for the wrong reasons. My knee-jerk reaction was to fight back, but I've learned that retaliation rarely results in positive dialogue, and my goal was to be heard, not get into a war. I took a beat. I silently prayed. I thought about what I really wanted to say and responded to Del Rio in her comments section. Here's what I wrote. "Why do you have to be so nasty to me? You don't know me or my heart. I'm not homophobic. And I'm always sad when people think otherwise. Loving Jesus doesn't mean I hate gay people or anyone. You sent a bunch of hateful people to my page writing horrible things. I hope next time you'll spread love and kindness, even when you disagree with people. Sending you love and wishing you all the best, truly." I'm usually pretty good at letting the negativity online roll off me. I usually don't engage with it because you can't ever win. I don't want to spend hours of my time on a thread of back and forths, trying to explain or defend myself, because that person on the other side of a screen somewhere will never really know me and my heart if we don't have a personal relationship. I'd rather invest my time in the relationships I do have. The same goes for you when you're engaged in that Facebook conversation with a friend of a friend of a friend who doesn't actually know you. I don't think it's worth it. But every once in a while, I mindfully choose to respond when someone attacks my character. One of the most difficult things for me personally is the divide between Christians and the LGBT community. It breaks my heart when I see so-called Christians holding up malicious signs that say, "God hates homosexuals." And it breaks my heart equally when an LGBT member calls all Christians homophobic. Neither is true, and that's why I couldn't let Bianca Del Rio's comment go without responding to it. I alone am not going to solve the problems between the church and the LGBT community, but my hope is to be a bridge builder. God calls us to love one another and to love our neighbors as ourselves. I believe this to mean Jesus calls us to love people who are not like us, even and especially when it's uncomfortable. While Del Rio's post upset me personally, I'm even more distressed to see the wide hurt and misunderstanding between these two communities God loves deeply. For the next few weeks, this exchange was covered widely in the media. I had said my piece and chose not to engage in any further back and forth. Though I quit reading the thread, people continued to comment on my original post. Overwhelmingly, the comments were supportive, but there were still many nasty comments. I believe the reason this got so much press was because even though I was attacked, I refused to be unkind. I didn't get pulled into a power play or a cat fight. I just stood up for myself and stayed true to my beliefs. One of the mantras I repeat to myself in moments like this is convictions of steel. You can push up against me or fire your weapons of criticism and disrespect, but I will not bend or break. God's word is like a rod of steel that runs straight up my spine. The world sees this and is very confused. It's uncommon. but it keeps me grounded. Media versus reality. You see, these days, loud emotional responses are the norm, or at least they are the responses that get the most attention on the news and through social media. Strong, negative feelings are more dramatic. The old journalism adage is still true. If it bleeds, it reads. Even if what is gushing out of us is nasty comments and conflict blown way out of proportion. I guess that drives more website traffic than positive, encouraging, loving behavior. We get used to seeing people handle things the wrong way. We see them blow up when a kind word could have diffused things. We see them lash out and get defensive, and it starts to feel like everyone acts that way all the time. Or like you have to be brash, abrasive, and cutthroat to get ahead. Lately, I've been on the lookout for people behaving well. If you're like me, when you start looking for grace, you'll be surprised to see that the 24-hour coverage of bad news doesn't always paint an accurate picture. Graciousness may never go viral, but the effects of small acts of kindness can nonetheless run deep. The truth plus grace. While on this mission to see graciousness from others, Val and I went to Best Buy. We'd just purchased a television and we pulled up to the front of the store so they could carry it out and put it in the car. As we sat waiting, I watched as a man in his early 20s started to back out of a parking space. Two other young men walked behind that car just as he was slowly pulling out. One of them slapped the back of the car and yelled. The driver rolled down his window and said, "I'm sorry." But the man who hit the car yelled back, "Get off your phone when you drive, man!" The driver repeated his apology. "Really, I apologize." I was getting nervous now, fearing this conflict might escalate into a physical fight. But the young driver kept his cool. He didn't get defensive. The other guy banged on the car again and said, "Get off your phone!" I gripped Val's arm, hoping the TV would be delivered quickly. There hadn't been any real wrongdoing, but this guy was acting belligerently. We watched as this young man pulled back into the parking space and took off his seatbelt. At this point, I thought, oh no. The man who yelled got into his truck and slammed the door. The young man walked calmly over to the truck and waved, signaling to the other man to roll down his window. We were close enough that I could hear him. I held my breath. He said, "I just wanted you to know that I wasn't on my phone. I looked in my rearview mirror, and honestly, I should have looked in the side mirror too. It's my fault, so I apologize, and I hope you have a good day. God bless." The man in the truck nodded. He seemed shocked. When the driver walked by, I gave him a thumbs up. Truly, I wanted to hug him or maybe call his mom and tell her what a great job she'd done raising him, but I restrained myself. It was the best thing I'd seen in a while. I hope this man's actions made an impact on the other man. I know they inspired me. Sometimes all it takes is one person's simple act of graciousness to turn our day, or maybe even our life, around. Keeping your cool on the hot topics. Nobody really likes conflict, but it's critical not to let fear of conflict control us. God has been training me for years in this. In fact, He's recently given me lots of practice. At times, all that training drove me to tears and brought me to my knees. I had the amazing privilege of being in millions of American homes every day on The View. Acting has always been my passion, and I've always loved the scripts and the story elements. So being on a panel talk show was a job I never sought out. As surprising and exciting as the initial offer to join The View was, I said no. First of all, there were logistical considerations. The show tapes live every weekday in New York, and we lived in Los Angeles. I didn't even have to discuss the possibility of asking my family to move across the country, knowing it was my daughter's senior year of high school, with my boys just 2 and 4 years behind her. I wasn't about to ask them to start over at this stage of their lives. Still, it was a proud moment for me, knowing I'd been offered the job, even if I wasn't going to take it. But a new offer came back with some adjustments to try to make it work. Val and I had talked and prayed for several days through every detail it would take for me to consider saying yes, and the contract wasn't even close. So we decided to pass again. Lo and behold, another offer came back with every detail laid out to address my every hesitation, such as flights to commute every week, working 4 of the 5 days a week so I could spend weekends at home, accommodations, and the ability to work around my previously contracted Hallmark movies and new show Fuller House. I got off the phone with my managers and stood in our kitchen staring at Val, stunned. They had gone out of their way to agree to our terms. I couldn't say no for any good reason. As queasy as I felt about how our lives were about to change in this new season, we all felt that this was a challenge God wanted me to take. We felt He was making a way. Motivated by my purpose, I saw this as an opportunity to live out my faith in front of a larger audience than I'd had the chance to connect with before. So I took the jump and said yes. As thrilling as it was to be in this new role, I also felt a level of pressure I had never experienced before. I've spent my entire career memorizing scripts with storylines. I always had a sense of how the scene would end or where the plot would turn next, but here I was on live national television, and it was my job to speak into events and issues of the day, which are often controversial. I knew God had given me this opportunity, yet I walked onto the set most days feeling ill-equipped to handle the challenges that came with the job. I felt leagues out of my comfort zone. Although I'm very comfortable and confident sharing my opinion on social issues and talking about my Christian faith, I'm an amateur at talking about politics. I didn't grow up in a family that talked about politics or even voted. Certainly, I had formed strong opinions as an adult over certain issues near my heart, but I wasn't experienced in verbalizing them in conversation. I also didn't have the historical knowledge or background that many of my co-hosts had when it came to discussing politics. And while the show producers told us they wanted to focus more on social issues than on politics that season, election year was right around the corner, making political dialogues inevitable. I was the least likely character to be in such a position of influence. But when I thought about it, I realized there are so many examples from Scripture of what I call unlikely characters. People like Moses, an adopted murderer who led God's people out of slavery. David, a sinful shepherd boy who became Israel's most beloved king. Esther, a beauty queen who petitioned a king to save God's people from annihilation. James and John, simple fishermen Jesus called to be among his first disciples. Paul, a persecutor of the Christians who wrote much of the New Testament after an encounter with Jesus changed everything. God has a long history of using unlikely candidates to bring himself glory. One thing they all have in common is that they listened to and leaned into God. I did not start one morning without rolling out of bed and onto the floor, sometimes on my knees, but mostly flat face to the ground, getting as low as possible to pray, listen, and put on the armor of God before heading out my door. That gave me a real sense of security, but it doesn't mean it wasn't tough. Every evening, we'd get emailed 60 to 80 topics to cover, all global current events. The next morning, the producers and co-hosts would gather for an hour to prepare by reviewing all the hot topics, adding additional ones that may have popped up overnight, and deciding which ones to discuss on the show that day. We all needed to speak up about which topics resonated with us, whether we had a strong opinion about one or another, and whether we had wisdom or history on each one. I'll be honest, unless it was a social, entertainment, sex, or parenting topic, I'd get scared out of my mind. Because of my lack of confidence, I'd spend 3 to 4 hours every evening researching political topics, so I felt somewhat prepared in the morning. It felt like cramming for a test each night and worrying that I might fail it no matter how hard I studied. Sometimes I simply didn't know enough history or current context to understand the nuances of a topic that may emerge in open conversation. That alone was a lot of pressure. Plus, it was live television, so we had to be ready for anything. Walking out on that stage every morning was intense. Some mornings, my adrenaline rushed even more than usual. I was a conservative voice, a Republican voice, and a Christian voice, and sometimes I felt pressure in knowing how to respond as such a representative. I could speak from experience, but knew my viewpoint wasn't always going to be well received by those with values different than mine. And the media was the first to point that out. It was tricky because I want to be a bridge builder, not a bridge burner, while also staying true to my beliefs. I'm not one who enjoys heated points and counterpoints, which is what The View is at times. I prefer to share my opinion, leave it there, and listen to the next person's. But I had to learn to jump back in for follow-up points to continue the conversation as much as time would allow. It gave me heartburn. It was safe to predict that I'd be in the minority opinion the majority of the time, because I was the most conservative voice at the table and outnumbered. I knew the others would ask me hard questions and challenge me, and that was to be expected. In those moments, my convictions of steel were a lifeline. But I can honestly say that I didn't take any of it personally. Opinions are just that, opinions. They are personal, but a person is always far more than their intellectual stances, and every person is always worthy of our respect, even if we don't agree with their views. Sometimes it's harder for people to discuss their opinions respectfully or calmly because they are incredibly passionate about the issue, and I get that. However, it didn't mean that I didn't have a million boo-hoo moments in my dressing room crying and praying about how I would get through the show or about how disappointed I was in myself for not expressing my thoughts the way I intended to. I put more pressure on myself than any one person put on me. Just ask the show's producers. They knew when to steer clear of my dressing room or coddle me after a tough show, for which I'll always be thankful. Dancing with the Stars also helped me learn how to handle conflict. We were under intense pressure physically and mentally. That led to relational and professional conflict that was often filmed for television. Looking back, I realized that my convictions of steel were forged in many furnaces, and God continues to stretch me and grow me. My prayer life is stronger than ever as a result of going through those seasons. The heat of the pressure just drove me further into dependence on God. For that, I'm forever grateful. Practical ways to handle conflict with grace. People sometimes ask me, how do you not lose it when you're being attacked and criticized? I got that question a lot when I was on The View, and I get it now whenever the media is dismissive of me in light of my faith or political views. Fans or viewers tell me they feel like fighting on my behalf, which I completely understand. What they really want to know is, how can I stay cool, calm, and collected when people are unkind to me? Here's the truth. I don't always feel calm. Rather, I'm mindful of my purpose, to glorify God in all I do. And that gives me an anchor. My deep desire is to extend to others just some of the grace constantly extended to me through Jesus Christ. My faith gives me presence of mind in those moments, and my prayer life gives me strength. When you have a direct line to the Creator of the universe, you don't feel as intimidated by worldly things. I can talk to God about anything, and He answers. Not always the way I want Him to or in the timeline I hoped for, but He always answers. Having been in this business for a long time, I've developed 5 secret tools that I use regularly to stay cool. You don't have to be an actress or have a job with intense public pressure to need these tools in your toolbox. We all face criticism and conflict, and we all need to know how to handle it with grace. Here are 5 methods I've learned along the way. Take deep breaths. When conflict comes, I take slow, measured breaths, counting to 3 as I inhale, then counting to 3 as I exhale. Do this a few times, and it's like a mental reset. It's easy to want to rush to act, but a few breaths work wonders for the body and soul. Breathing helps me quiet the other voices so I can hear God speaking peace and assurance. God's supernatural peace is promised to all believers. Philippians 4, verse 7 makes this comforting promise. The peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. God's peace is available to me, and it will guard my heart and mind in a conflict. When my emotions start to surge, I need a breath or two to remind me of this truth. Sometimes a few breaths is all it takes. Take a beat. I borrowed this from my acting career. Taking a beat means sitting still for a moment to let the previous line or joke sink in. I often count quietly to myself. This does not always come easily. It's a discipline I've learned over time, but when I put it into practice, I always feel more in control, which makes everything much easier. I found that when I take a beat, I can smile after a few breaths. I'm not talking about a pasted-on smile. I'm not ignoring the situation in front of me, but taking a breath and then taking a beat helps me tap into a peace that pervades the rocky moments. I've experienced that peace more times than I can count. Switch roles. After I breathe and take a beat to remember who or whose I am, I mentally switch sides, trying to think about the other person's perspective. Most often when I do this, I discover that the other person's words or behavior reveals fear, pain, sadness, or discomfort. When I see the vulnerable person behind the fuss, compassion comes naturally. This is one way my belief that all people are made in the image of God plays out practically. We each have God-given value and God-given emotions. When I remember that my opponent in a conflict is an image bearer, empathy always bubbles up in my heart. Go to God first. Sometimes I need to sit with my emotional response for a while. I need to name my feelings. I'm feeling defensive, or what they said about me hurt because I worked so hard. I don't try to fight how I feel because emotions aren't right or wrong. They are value neutral. It's how we behave that is right or wrong. The Bible says, "Be angry and do not sin," Ephesians 4, verse 26, New King James Version. In other words, feel what you're feeling, but don't hurt others with your words or actions. When we seek the best for everyone, a win-win is possible. So sometimes I count to 10, say a quick prayer, and then act. Or other times I may need to sleep on it before I can act. But whatever the case, I pray. God's word says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God which surpasses all understanding will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Philippians 4, verse 6 and 7, New King James Version. What is the antidote to anxiety? Thankful prayer. That means I should be grateful for the person and the circumstance. After all, God allowed this moment into my life for a reason, whether for discipline or for blessing, or maybe so I could be a blessing to someone else. Honestly, I don't usually know why, but I believe that He is a good Father and that He has control. So I need to thank Him for all those things and trust. Prayer is how I do that best. Ask for what you want. Here's the hardest part of conflict for me. asking for what I want. It's my job to give voice to my needs and concerns. It's nobody else's job but mine. That's been a hard lesson for me. I could have saved myself a lot of heartache if I had learned it sooner. Women especially seem to have a hard time with this one. Culturally, many of us have been trained not to speak up for what we want. But frankly, if we don't, who will? It's foolish, actually ridiculous, to complain about not having what you want if you don't speak up for yourself and ask. I'm not talking about demanding what we want or making requests in ways that are angry and entitled. But it has helped me tremendously to realize that I am the one who must give voice to what I need. Rather than simply venting my emotions or cataloging my complaint, I try to cut to the chase in a conflict and calmly, respectfully ask for what I want. Here's an amazing truth I never thought I'd write. I've learned that sometimes I have to create conflict when my impulse is to keep my mouth closed for the sake of peace. It's my job to stand my ground sometimes. It's your job to stand your ground sometimes too. The challenge is to do it with elegance and conviction. To keep it classy by keeping it kind, no matter what conflict comes our way. Your turn. Wish you could have a do-over on a recent conflict. We can all think of situations in which we didn't handle things in a way that was classy or kind. Now imagine yourself back in that moment and picture yourself going through the 5 steps. Number 1, take deep breaths. Number 2, take a beat. Number 3, switch roles. Number 4, pray first. Number 5, ask for what you want. How might your situation have turned out differently? The bad news is we cannot go back. You cannot undo past actions, but you may still have an opportunity to respond with kindness and class. Could you make a phone call or write a note to the individual you are thinking of and let them know you wish you'd handled things differently? Think of the young man in the Best Buy parking lot. It took some guts to get out of his car to talk to the man he offended. There was no guaranteed outcome. It certainly would have been more convenient for him to simply stay in his car and drive away. He took the high road instead. You can too. Admitting our mistakes is part of being gracious. You also have the opportunity to do things differently in the future. Whether it's a tiny passive-aggressive comment or a full blow-up, conflict is an inevitable part of life. We can't control that, but we can control our response. There will be plenty of opportunities for your convictions of steel to be forged and strengthened. Will you take them? These are not easy choices, but we have good reason to make them. After all, it's your character on the line. But do you know what? Even when it's tempting for me to react in anger or frustration, I'm reminded that my character is precious and not worth wasting on a moment's flare-up. Your integrity is worth so much more than proving a point or having the last word. Because when we lash back, we stoop to our challenger's level of meanness. At the end of the day, that's not what we really want. The choice is ours. We can react in the heat of our emotions, or we can respond with grace. As women responsible for our own actions, we can choose a reactive response or a redemptive response. I vote we take the high road. Let's keep it classy and choose kindness. Chapter 3. Kindness, please. Kindness recognizes the image of God in all people. When I was filming The View in New York City, I rode the subway. Every day. Multiple times a day. Glamorous, I know. As a California girl, used to the wind in my hair, I found that traveling in the dark underground was hard to get used to. But any self-respecting New Yorker has a Metro card. It's just part of living in the city. One afternoon, headed home after my workout, I stepped onto the sweaty, standing-room-only subway car at rush hour. Picture me wearing gym clothes, running shoes, a baseball cap, backpack on my back, earbuds in, trying to be incognito. Got the picture? Maybe this'll help. Imagine me peeking out from under some tall man's arm, trying to keep a grip on the germy pole while the car jerks and screeches to a stop. As I stood there, a woman who looked at least 8 months pregnant slid in and grabbed a pole near me. I stood there feeling helpless and anxious, scanning the car, hoping someone would give up their seat for her. I've been pregnant 3 times. It wasn't too hard to imagine how miserable it would be to stand in a crowded, jerky car with feet swollen after a long day. But all eyes in the subway car were either closed or focused on their phones. Each time we stopped and a seat opened, someone would slide into it before this woman could get there. It was so frustrating to watch. I could hear my mother's voice saying, "What kind of person lets a pregnant woman ride 40 blocks standing?" Part of me wanted to yell at the other commuters, but I knew that wouldn't help. So I did what I could. I caught the woman's eye, a real no-no on the subway, and compassionately smiled. The relief in the smile she returned made my day. Is a smile between strangers on the subway a little thing? Sure, but it's the little things that keep us going, the small gestures of compassion and kindness that give us strength to carry on in a crazy day in this crazy world. Maybe a smile doesn't seem like much, but in a city where people are so quick to get where they're going, where we pass each other by without any human interaction, it mattered to me. This woman and I saw each other, even if just for an instant. That's the invitation kindness offers to you and me. Will we stop for even a moment to truly see each other? Every person we pass every day, whether on the street or in the subway, in the checkout line or carpool line, possesses an incredible story, often mixed with beauty and pain. I see you, sister. Some days, it can be as simple as that. Good reason to respect all. When you think about it, we're all looking for a bit of simple kindness. We have a deep desire for empathy, some little sign that another person can imagine walking in our shoes. We want to feel valued, respected, and loved. And when we don't feel like we're being respected or loved, that's when we can get out of sorts. We're all prone to feeling tired, overworked, and underappreciated. In those moments, we forget to be empathetic, to consider how the tired, overworked, and underappreciated people around us feel. Ironically, we tend to be least empathetic when others are unkind to us. Rather than stopping to consider what might be causing them to act so prickly, we respond by being rude in return. Rudeness compounds rudeness. It's a cycle that can go on indefinitely. That's the bad news. Here's the good news. This is a cycle we can break, one interaction at a time. Consider for a moment Genesis 1, verse 27. God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Don't race past this. It's too important. What we read here is that humans were made in the image of God. Bible scholars call this idea the Imago Dei. There's such dignity and holiness in this truth. God is the definition of all good things, and we are made in God's image. Each and every one of us mirrors our Creator in a unique way. That alone is reason for us to respect each other. They'll know us by our kindness. I'm fascinated by the examples of Jesus extending kindness to others, sometimes in extravagant ways and sometimes in simple ways. When we start looking for these stories in God's Word, we find that they're abundant. I'm sure you can think of at least a few right now. Here are some of my favorites. He responded with kindness and compassion to the woman who touched the hem of his robe, hoping to be healed. Matthew 9, verse 20 through 22. He treated the Samaritan woman with dignity, even though she was from a people group that others avoided. John 4, verses 1 through 42. He extended courtesy and hope to the thieves who hung beside him on the cross, even though they were criminals. Luke 23, verses 39 through 43. What strikes me as important is that Jesus' kindness wasn't conditional. Think about the chain reaction of rudeness we often fall into. If someone snaps at us, we're likely to snap back at someone else. If someone cuts you off on the road, you're apt to arrive at your destination frazzled and frustrated. But Jesus didn't base his kindness toward others on how others treated him. He recognized the image of God in every person he encountered, and he extended kindness no matter what treatment he might receive in return. What's more, Jesus did this for our example. He wanted his disciples to be kind too. Do you know what he said in John 13? "By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Verse 35. That kind of dynamic, people being genuinely good to each other, is so rare these days and so, so needed. It's probably safe to say that those of us in the entertainment industry aren't always known for our love of each other. I have to admit, there's a great deal of ugliness in this business. Lots of beautiful people, for sure, but the pettiness and infighting could make the top reality shows blush. But here's the thing. I don't want that to be true of me. I truly want to honor what Jesus said, so people will recognize me as his disciple. And that means being kind. So what will that look like practically? I'm so glad you asked. Manners matter. When I was growing up, my parents taught us the value of good manners. I can remember my parents interrupting the family meal to correct the way I held my fork and knife, mandating that we write thank you notes, and making sure we treated our elders respectfully. We were raised with the understanding that if a person didn't have good manners, they wouldn't get very far in life. Schools taught good manners too. We learned the value of taking turns. We stood in line quietly and patiently. We let older people go first. We always said please and thank you. Today, tolerance has replaced good manners as the ultimate value to be taught and practiced. There's a cultural mandate in America that we will tolerate any and all belief systems and modes of behavior. But have you ever thought about that word, tolerate? It's a pretty low bar to clear. I can tolerate the sound of fingernails scraping the chalkboard, but it doesn't mean I like it or respect it. Personally, I think we can do better than merely tolerating each other. What I'd like to advocate is good manners. It's a simple enough switch, but I believe that if we'd all use good manners, tolerance would be more peaceful and productive. What do I mean by good manners? I'm talking about common courtesy. Good manners are the way we convey to others that we believe they are worthwhile, that they have inherent dignity because they are made in the image of God. Good manners are simply love in action. Isn't that more powerful than simply tolerating someone? By the end of the day, do you want to be valued and respected, or do you want to be tolerated? I know which one I'd choose. Here's where it gets interesting. Not only are courtesy and good manners respectful of others, they command respect in return. They will set you apart in a positive way and put others at ease. As you make an effort to be more courteous, you will notice that others begin to treat you with dignity because you extended respect, even in small acts like saying please and thank you. The science of kindness. Still not convinced that manners make a difference? Does simply saying thank you feel futile in a culture where the clash of ideas and opinions has become so loud? Let's look at the science. There's increasing scientific evidence that kindness is good for us, which tells me human kindness was God's plan from the beginning. Acts of courtesy and kindness have been shown to stimulate the production of serotonin, the chemical that calms us down and makes us feel happy. Kindness also produces endorphins, the chemical that makes us feel pleasure. And kindness produces oxytocin, which makes us feel calm, promotes social bonding, increases trust and generosity, and helps our bodies fight disease by strengthening our immune systems. Studies have found that kindness increases our mental, emotional, and physical energy, while on the flip side, working to combat negative forces like anxiety and high blood pressure. Oh, and compassionate people, the ones who show kindness out of concern for others, have 23% less cortisol, the stress hormone. Kindness is a natural stress reliever. How cool is that? Not only does being kind have an effect on those around you, your kindness has the power to make you feel happy, contented, pleased, and calm. Researchers call this the helper's high. It's such a rewarding experience that those who extend kindness to others are often motivated to repeat their actions in the future. When we realize that offering an encouraging word, an act of service, or a generous gift is such a pleasant experience, our brains take note and create a positive feedback loop that encourages us to act kindly at the next opportunity. What's so amazing about this is that the serotonin, endorphin, and oxytocin boost works for the person offering kindness, for the person receiving it, and for those witnessing it. Maybe this is why kindness is so contagious. When others observe its many far-reaching benefits, they want it too. Kindness sends out chemical shockwaves. So if you're ever tempted to think your small acts of selflessness don't count for much, think again. Those random acts of kindness are more potent than you might realize, and they're likely to create a ripple effect God will use for good. My friend and manager, Jeffrey, will often randomly text me, "Need anything?" I can't tell you how much those two words have instantly comforted me and relaxed me, even in the most stressful of moments. Just knowing someone is thinking of me and available to help if I need it is so reassuring. And every once in a while, I do need it. I've adopted this simple act of kindness from him. I like to ask some of my friends and family unexpectedly, "Need anything?" Training equals habit. The foundation for good manners isn't just sticking to an antiquated set of expectations enforced by our grandparents. Instead, it is this idea that we each have value and we ought to find ways to show it. Good manners are about putting others' needs first, before your own. Val and I place a high value on teaching our kids to greet people well, to look them in the eye, to give a firm handshake. It's important to us that our kids know how to talk to adults. We remind them not to give one-word answers. When someone asks them a question like, "How are you?" the person is trying to engage. We tell our kids to be gracious about it and not take it for granted as a way of showing the person that he or she matters. In our digital culture, the personal greeting has become somewhat of a lost art. These days, we can simply press a few buttons, and this is counted as personal engagement, liking a post, using texting shorthand, or sending a GIF to say happy birthday instead of taking the time to pick up a phone and call or send a card in the mail. These things aren't necessarily bad, but sometimes I think we take the easy way out when it comes to interpersonal communication, and I think we miss out when we do this. It's up to us to turn it around. In a million little ways, we can use good manners to assign dignity to others. To train my boys along these lines, if I'm with them, I won't open a door for myself. They know they must open doors for me as well as for other women. Although I am perfectly capable of carrying my grocery bags, my boys know they need to grab them because I've taught them to be helpful to their mom, a lesson that will carry over to their future wives. My husband does all the cooking, so as a gesture of gratitude, I do all the kitchen cleaning. I've also taught my kids that if someone leaves dishes in the sink, then as a courtesy to everyone who lives in the house, it's thoughtful to clean up after them, even if it's your annoying brother. Courtesy means you look around to see if someone needs anything. Through manners, we are teaching our children to put others' needs ahead of their own preferences. This means that even with two teenage boys in the house, loud belching is not allowed. Can I get an amen? Should I respond? Certain sounds make me happy. My workout playlist, the sound of my children's laughter, the quiet rhythm of waves on the beach. At the same time, the world around us is often filled with sound that is simply noise. The Bible calls it clamor. Out of sheer necessity, we sometimes tune out human voices. Listening to someone and giving them your full attention may have once been society's norm, but today, with so many modern distractions, giving your full attention to someone is a gift. I'll never forget the time I flew to New York to be on Good Morning America and was told that actress Kerry Washington from the mega-hit TV show Scandal was also there to be interviewed. Not only that, but apparently she wanted to say hi to me. I don't know if I can describe how much I was freaking out on the inside. I love Kerry Washington, like love, love, love her. And she just asked to say hi to me? Yes, even celebrities get starstruck. Although I had exchanged a few emails with Kerry, it was the first time I'd met her, and she made me feel as if I were the only person in the room. She looked at me in the eyes and kept her focus on me rather than scanning the room for other, more important people to talk to. She asked me questions like, what was I there to promote on the morning show? And then told me how much she loved my book Reshaping It All, and that she was proud of me for writing it. Huh? You read my book? I was squealing to myself. Celebrity or not, when someone gives you their full attention, even if only for a few minutes, it makes you feel like you matter, like you're of value, like you're worth it. In our modern culture of distractions, one of the greatest gifts we can give each other is to shut out the noise, to engage a single person, one-on-one. We all have that choice to make in every interaction. Have you ever had someone listen to you in a way that felt really engaging? Whether it's 2 minutes or 20, it always feels like a precious gift. Thinking of the moments when I've taken time to listen, I found that often listening was a gift to me, the hearer, as well. Sometimes kindness looks like generous listening. I've experienced my share of unkind words and actions over the years, when people chose to make snap judgments instead of listening. It comes with the territory of living in the public eye, I guess. I've developed a pretty thick skin over the years, but it still hurts when people make judgments and criticize me and correct me according to their limited insight into my day. One of the hardest parts about being on The View was reading social media comments after a show aired. Producers tell you not to look at it or pay attention to it, but to me, it was helpful to hear people's feedback, good or bad, so I could better understand how to approach a topic or articulate a viewpoint if the issue came up again. But weeding through the junk to get to the constructive content would make just about anyone want to curl up and cry. People called me profane names and told me to shut up. You are so stupid, they wrote, or hashtag dumb blonde, Candace needs a brain transplant. You don't deserve to breathe my air. You are a robot with your goody two-shoes. We'd all be better off if you were dead. I received comments such as these every day of the week. But the worst comments, I felt, were the ones from so-called well-meaning Christians. I dare you to scroll through my Facebook page and take a look at the comments. It doesn't take long for the judgment of God's people to show up. You're a bigot and a false Christian, people tell me, in reference to a video of me dancing at a birthday party. When I was saved, I was told that dancing in this manner was wrong and worldly, just saying. In reference to a dress, that neckline is way too low. Also, she's a hypocrite-type Christian. She's one that looks back and gets turned into salt. Obsessed much? So many posts are about her exercising. I responded to this one recently, deciding to speak from my heart and let people know that I'm a real person with real feelings just like them. I wrote back to this woman. It's so disheartening reading the comments. In my last 15 posts, two of them were about fitness. The rest were about God, my family, and work. The people who complain only see what they want to see. It's not even worth my time writing this. To all of you who support me, thank you. I've learned, and continue to learn, to let most of it roll off my back. Certainly, I wish there were a button I could push that would illuminate in neon letters the words, "Kindness, please!" Here's why I use the time-tested maxim, "If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all." Can't you just hear your mother or grandmother saying that? Notice I didn't say, "Only say something if you can sound smart or wise," or "Only say something if you know it will help you win the debate." If it's not nice, don't say it. You'll be sparing the listener and yourself the embarrassment of saying something offensive or hurtful. The Apostle Paul gave this advice when writing to his protege Timothy. The Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but must be kind to everyone. 2 Timothy 2, verse 24. Paul wrote these words more than 2,000 years before the World Wide Web, but they still apply. Perhaps online more than in any other sphere. There's a time for us to speak truth into the lives of the people we're closest to, our spouses, our children, our dearest friends. But if we've got something hard and critical to say, we must practice restraint. That kind of thing should only be said when and if you're in a true relationship with another person, when you've built trust and therefore earned the right to be heard. If I've learned anything about conflict over the years, it's this. Hard truths are not for strangers. Some days I watch the news or look through my news feed, and the lies I see people believing are astounding to me. It feels personal, and I want to help people understand and see the hot issue of the day from a different point of view. But I've learned to conserve my energy. If you don't have a relationship with someone, don't expect to be able to speak into that person's life and be heard. Respect no matter what. I have a dear friend named Ron. He's a director whom I admire and adore hanging out with. I got to know Ron when he directed me in the Hallmark movie, A Christmas Detour, in 2015. He's always impeccably dressed, wearing a blazer, cufflinks, and a bow tie every day to work while the rest of us are in sweats. He keeps a very fun and happy set with music blasting between scenes and with his witty, dry, sarcastic sense of humor. He talks about himself in the third person and is unrestrained. He is a gem, and I love him with all my heart. Ron is also quite the opposite of me in many regards. He's a far-left liberal, a gay man, and an atheist. When I started working on The View, I would post clips of my segments that were important to me on my personal Facebook page. Ron would post on his Facebook page about the same topic, but the antithesis of what I was saying, and it always seemed to happen soon after I posted. I usually don't engage online when my viewpoint is the complete opposite. I never engaged in Facebook debates, and I wasn't about to start. I also don't like reading into someone's posts and making them about me. It's easy to take things personally online or speculate that a barb is directed at you, when in reality it has nothing to do with you. But I saw his posts, seemingly a direct response to mine, 3 or 4 times in a row, and it made my heart race. Am I blatantly offending him with my viewpoint? Is he passive-aggressively responding to me? Should I be taking this personally? Is he wanting to unfriend me? It bothered me so much that I prayed about it for 3 days, and I still couldn't get it off my mind. My heart pounded every time I thought about it. I knew I needed to talk to Ron directly. I didn't believe dancing around the issue or brushing it off would be good for either of us. It would build up fear and resentment in my heart, and what's more, I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. So I picked up the phone and called him. He was surprised to hear from me, but glad. I bumbled my way through an awkward confession that I was feeling sad and uncomfortable about our back-to-back postings and thought maybe there was something we needed to talk about. I told him, "You're my friend. I love you and respect you and your opinion regardless of whether I agree with it. But I'm wondering if you are sometimes responding to me with your posts without having to say it to my face." I took a deep breath and waited to see what reaction would come. This would either be the end of a friendship or the beginning of a deeper one. I just didn't know which, and it wasn't up to me. "First of all," Ron said after what seemed like an eternity, "the fact that you called me because you feel so bothered by this is mind-blowing to me. You are so bold." We talked about our posts, which he said really were coincidental in timing. That's what we get for both keeping up on the news and current events. We even talked through our viewpoints on some of those specific topics, as well as why Jesus and the Bible were so important to me. We had a delightfully wonderful conversation, and I was so relieved. I knew this moment was going to build a stronger bridge for our friendship. At the end of our call, Ron said, "If there's such a thing as a good Christian person, you just showed me. I appreciate that I meant enough for you to call me to resolve your feelings and not just sweep them under the rug." It was connection, pure and simple. I didn't have all the answers. It wasn't about being wrong or right. I was simply being honest, courteous, and kind, and it made a big difference. I wasn't afraid to share biblical truth with him, but I wasn't forcing the issue either. We were just two friends being respectful and kind in conversation with each other. Kindness doesn't mean we always agree. We don't have to only be friends with like-minded people. We simply need to be kind to all people regardless of whether we agree with them. We're all made in the image of God, no exceptions. And Jesus was kind to all, no exceptions. Who are we to think we can act differently? In the end, that's what matters. Kindness, compassion, and empathy are values we can all get behind, regardless of whether we agree on every issue. Look, I know it can be overwhelming to see how the hot-button issues often bring out hate. Our convictions can get us riled up, and sometimes, as heat rises, controversies can get out of control. It's easy to wonder, how can anything I do make a difference when the loudest voices always seem to win? I'm here to tell you there is something you can do. Kindness isn't all meek and mild. Kindness is powerful. Because think about it. Kindness transcends every barrier we can put up between us, whether religious, political, racial, or anything else that divides us. It's potent stuff. Let's face it. We don't gain anything by yelling and scaring people. When was the last time your opinion was changed through a heated Facebook debate? When there is conflict, and there will be, offer the olive branch instead. The easy thing to do is react and condescend, to let our words keep pace with the hustle and bustle of our lives, to give back what we get. But we stand out when we resist the urge to be combative. Some people hate being wrong. Me? I don't want to be wrong, but I see it as an opportunity to learn. I thrive on improving and getting better. I see failure as an opportunity to stretch and grow and to lean into my higher purpose, to bring God glory. Your turn. Maybe you want to be kind and have good manners, but in this upside-down world, you hardly know where to start. That's the beauty of manners. Little things can make a big impact. Try these 5 things for the next month and notice the difference. Number 1, smile. Be pleasant. Smiling communicates that others matter, and your smile will infuse your own attitude. The more you shape your actions to respect others, the more you will believe they are worthy of your respect. Number 2, offer a warm greeting. Say hello and give a firm handshake or a warm hug. It's amazing how this sets a tone of respect and courtesy. To go the extra mile as you greet someone, say their name. We all want to be seen and known. Speaking someone's name with a warm smile.